Welcome. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our usual host, Monica Hadley, is not with us today, or her mother, Carolyn. However, I'm happy to say that we have a fabulous guest with us today. It's Dan Buettner. He's a little bit hard to categorize because he's kind of got a lot of different hats that he wears. He authored a New York Times bestseller about longevity called The Blue Zones, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who've Lived the Longest, as well as another very popular nonfiction book called Thrive, Finding Happiness the Blue Zones Way. Both books were published by National Geographic Books. In addition to being an author and public speaker, Buettner holds three world records for endurance bicycling. His first trip, America's Trek, took him from Alaska to the tip of Argentina. In the second trip, Soviet Trek, he traversed the USSR, and in the third, he explored Africa. He also founded the Quest Network to encourage students to interact with explorers during expeditions. In conjunction with that enterprise, he embarked on quests to explore world mysteries. Dan also founded Blue Zones, an organization that researches the world's best practices in health, longevity, and happiness, and helps communities implement some of those practices to improve their citizens' qualities of life. Welcome, Dan. We're thrilled to have you with us today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
And I understand you're in Minnesota right now.
Beautiful Minneapolis, yes. Just, you know, right up 35 from you. And we're at Blue Zones headquarters.
Well, I have lots of questions for you today. My first one is, your career is one that most people probably envy. And I'm wondering if, as a young person, you imagined yourself ending up doing the things you're doing today. And did you consciously plan for the life that you're leading?
I did not. I've been a lifelong explorer, and I've always more or less done exactly what interests me and exactly where my curiosity lies. I just followed my curiosity. And I really struck off to just be an explorer, to find parts of the world where people haven't seen or experienced much and report on them. But ultimately, you find that to be a modern-day explorer, to find the resources to pay for the trips, you need to bring something back that people care about, that add to the body of knowledge or educate or somehow enlighten people. And that's how I got into this Blue Zone work and this Thrive work.
It sounds like you started off pretty early, and then like by winning trips through selling newspaper subscriptions is how you started your travels, is that right?
Yes, I sold the Steam Star Tribune newspaper And when I was 14, and I was diligent enough at it that I'd win trips to places like Florida or Spain or the Virgin Islands, Morocco, and got the bug for traveling there. I realized that that there's a huge world outside the Midwest, and once you get a taste of it, it's addictive. It's, you know, I like good coffee.
So it sounds like your parents must have been adventurous too to let you go off on these trips that you won.
My dad and mom are phenomenal. They're retired now, but they take about seven trips a year, and every time they come back from China or Africa or South America, they say, "We just spent more of your inheritance." They're gone right now. But yeah, I had a father who would take us into the woods for an hour at a time when we were 5 years old. I'm sorry, an hour at a time, but weeks at a time when we were 5 years old, and taught us how to be self-sufficient, live off the land, and those were great tools for later in life.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So it also seems to me like in my reading about you that you had a serendipitous meeting with someone who knew George Plimpton, who's also like you, or was also sort of a participatory journalist, where he would undertake, you know, unusual enterprises and then write about them. So that must have been a kind of a lucky meeting for you.
It was. I worked for Ramar Sutton to help organize the celebrity croquet tournament for National Public Radio. And during the course of that year, I met George Plimpton, who was our celebrity host, and I think I know he took shine to me. We became great friends, and over the next 20 years, he not only encouraged me, but gave me kind of the mental and psychological tools to go out and think big and to do things that other people might be interested in and then to learn how to write about them. And that was a gift. George Plimpton, as you may remember, was the founder and editor for about 25 years of the Paris Review, which is a great literary journal. And he wrote Paper Lion and Shadow Boxers. And then
he did a lot of the things, right? Like he boxed, and then he wrote about boxing, boxed with professionals.
He boxed with Archie Moore, who was one of the great champs of the time. And George was this lanky, tall, erudite blue blood. And he was more comfortable in tweeds than he was in any boxing shorts. And he'd get in the ring. He actually got to throw a pass in a professional NFL game. He played with the Detroit Lions, charmed his way into the locker room. And maybe you remember Walter Mitty. It was James Thurber, who's the Secret Life of Walter Mitty. George was kind of a real-life Walter Mitty. He tried to think of what the average person would dream of doing, whether it's a sports fan playing football or a boxing fan in the ring or somebody enjoys a symphony playing the triangle. And then he wrote about it. And he wrote about it with great literary flair and in a way that it didn't make him feel superior, but made him feel like an alter ego of his readers.
Well, what an interesting person!
He was a great person.
Do you see?
I felt he was my best friend, but of course, when he died 6 years ago, I met 1,000 other people who all thought that George was his best friend. He had an amazing following, amazing personality.
Well, do you see parallels with your own career? I mean, being both an explorer and a writer, and he was sort of an explorer and a writer.
Yeah, he was unquestionably my forefather in what I'm doing. The guy who gave me the idea and shaped the way I ended up doing it. But of course, you can't just do the same thing over and over. You have to think of new ways. And so my particular forte is I think a lot of people out there are interested in living longer and being healthier and being happier. So.
Well, I think everybody's interested in that. So tell us a little about how you launched into Blue Zones and like where that first book, The Blue Zones, came from.
I did a series of interactive expeditions, scientific expeditions, and I got really good at networking with top experts and using an online audience to help solve a mystery. And along the way, we stumbled upon a mystery in Okinawa, Japan. People were living longer disability-free lives there than any place else on the planet. And the Japanese government hired my team to come in and try to figure out exactly what was going on and do one of these live interactive expeditions. And later on, I noticed that we had amazing web traffic for that, and I kind of trotted the idea into National Geographic with the suggestion that, well, if there's one in Okinawa, there must be one in Europe, and maybe one in Africa, and maybe one in South America, these areas where people are living longer. And the editor liked it, nodded, and he said, go to work. And over the course of 3 years, I found 5 longevity hotspots. They're often called blue zones. Took teams of experts there and wrote about them. The first began as a cover story for National Geographic, which was one of its best-selling issues in history, and now it's a book.
So there's many things that interest me about this part of your life, and one is, this seems like it was a little bit through serendipity as well. I think I read that a Japanese woman approached you at a conference in California, wanted you to go to Japan, and then flew out later to see you in Minnesota to convince you to go. Is that right? Or is that mythology?
She was on a contract from the Japanese government to try to get Japanese to thinking more critically. Instead of the rote education, Japanese were interested in how American students are learning critical thinking skills. And our methodology for uncovering mysteries, including this mystery of longevity, was to let an online audience of kids direct a team of experts, or at least have input. And that's what they originally brought us in for, was this educational innovation. But what emerged from it was more an innovation on how to live longer. Uh, if only 20% of how long you live is dictated by your genes. The other 80% of it is lifestyle. Where are people indeed living longer?
So to me, it seems like there was this openness that you were open to going to Japan at this woman's, you know, urging. And then that led you to discover these pockets of longevity and got you involved in this other project.
Yes.
So it seems like one of the key marks of like having maybe a successful career the way you are is kind of being open to the experiences that come to you.
Yes, I would say so. And following your bliss.
So another question I have is the books that you've written, you know, you've had to interview a lot of people, and I'm wondering, did you have to do anything to hone your interviewing skills, or have you always just been the kind of person that, you know, people are willing to open up to?
I'm pretty good about getting people to open up. I've spent some time finding out about them or seeing if they want to know what I'm up to and making it a two-way conversation rather as opposed to extracting a bunch of information and then moving on. The technique, though, for Blue Zones and Thrives is not a compendium of interviews. What we do is we find what are the components that explain longevity from a macro point of view.
And you do that. Do you do that by talking to the experts in the field?
By talking to experts, by crunching data, and by pulling all the scientific studies. So you understand what are the components that explain longevity here. And then you try to find characters who personify or are emblems of that prototypical lifestyle. And then you interview them. And you kiss a lot of frogs before you get somebody who just happens to eat the national diet and sleep the right amount and take the right herbs and connect in the right way and have a religious component. So then once you find the person that fits the template, then you can tell that person's story.
And then they also have
the story of a bigger place. So it's story-driven science as opposed to a bunch of anecdotes, which the way most people who write about longevity do it.
Well, that's interesting, because you need the story or it's not going to be digestible to the public at large. But I can see what you're saying. If it's only the story, then it doesn't have enough science behind it.
Right.
So do you feel that part of your success is being an early adopter of technology? It seems to me like that's a big part of it.
That was really important for those interactive expeditions we call quests. In fact, it was crucial, but it's less important now. I use mostly techniques of epidemiology, anthropology, demographics to do my work now, and storytelling. And it's less about technology isn't that important. Maybe using Skype to be able to call somebody on the other side of the planet and not have to worry about it. But
Well, that's interesting. So you don't feel like technology is that important in your career now as it was in the beginning when you were doing the expedition and working with schools?
Correct.
So one thing that I'm curious about is just in the process of writing, it seems like you must amass a ton of material, partly when you're doing this global thing and contacting the experts, and then when you're going out and trying to find people who exemplify the principles. How do you digest that material? Like, do you end up with hundreds of hours of recordings and pages of data?
Yeah, I would say to write Blue Zones, which is about 300 pages, I probably had 5,000 pages of... I pull every single article and read all of those first, all the academic articles. And then from that, you get a pretty clear idea of who the experts are, and you network your way to the top people in the field, and then a real conversation with them, or I try to fly out and meet them. And after that's done, then you can start to figure out who in the countries that you're covering you want to meet. And then once you do that, then you kind of change gears. You distill down, okay, what's the recipe here? And then you find the characters that cover it. But yes, for every word I write, I've digested 50 words.
Well, is that difficult for you? Because you know, you're a world-class cyclist, and, you know, you're kind of, it seems like you're a very active person. So is having to do all this research onerous, or is that something you're also drawn to?
Well, to be clear, I was a world-class cyclist. I set 3 world records, but that was 15 years ago. And I also have a full-time researcher on my staff who helps. And I spend a ton of time on airplanes, and so I do a lot of reading.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I take a highlighter and a cup of coffee, and I will mulch through hundreds of pages on a flight.
Interesting.
And I'm pretty good at throwing quickly, discarding something that's not going to be useful, and setting aside the useful stuff. Which, and I don't have a great memory, but I know where to put things, so I know where to find them when I get around to writing about it.
Okay, well, I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU FM 100.1. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson on Writer's Voices, and with me today we have Dan Buettner, the author of the Blue Zones book and another book called Thrive. And I'm wondering if you would share some of the 9 principles of longevity with our listeners, Dan.
Well, no matter where you go, whether it's Okinawa or Sardinia, Italy, or the Kola Peninsula of Costa Rica, or Ikaria, Greece, or among the Seventh-day Adventists, you see the same 9 things happening over and over and over again among the longest-lived people. And the first one has to do with physical activity. You know, we think, well, we'll exercise our way to health, but that really hasn't worked in America. The average American burns fewer than 100 calories a day engaged in exercise.
Wow, that's not very much.
We don't do it. 68% of Iowans are overweight or obese. So that's not working. What you see among centenarians in the world or long-lived populations is they live in areas that nudge them into constant physical activity. They go to the store, to go to school, to go to church, to go to the friend's house. It almost always occasions a walk. Their houses are not convenient to the hill. There's not a button to push for everything. They do a lot of work by hand. They still have gardens. Their idea of a good time is a walk with a friend. It's not an obligation that you do on a treadmill. So I think that's a big idea, actually, that we ought to think about here in America. The second category is downshifting. If you think about these places, people often think, well, if I lived on an island in the Mediterranean or in Southeast Asia, I wouldn't be stressed either. But the fact is, these people are worried about the same things we're worried about. They're worried about their kids. They're worried about their health. They're worried about their finances. They tend to be pretty poor people. But what they have that we often don't are ways to shed stress. They pray. They meditate. They take a nap. They do happy hour. And these are all things that reverse the inflammation that comes with hurry and worry. And that inflammation, that releasing of these corrosive hormones that wreak havoc on your joints and your arteries and shrink your brain and wrinkle your skin, those are things that every human has. But what people in Blue Zones do is they have a way to reverse that chronic inflammation. And so those are a couple.
Okay. So I'm curious, as you learned about these things, it sounded like you probably were already living a pretty healthy lifestyle, but as you learned about the different practices of people in these pockets of longevity, did you change the way that you lived at all?
I wasn't necessarily the most healthy guy in the world. In fact, as I like to say, I'm not your guru, but I can tell you what the world's longest lived people. I tend to eat a plant-based diet, which we know. We know that people eat nuts 4 times a week, a couple handfuls, live longer than people who don't eat nuts, so I have nuts sitting around. I have a great family in whom I invest a lot of time and effort. I have a social network that's really positive. It turns out that your health behaviors are as contagious as, or health habits are as contagious as a cold or a flu. So if you're hanging out with obese people who are unhappy, who smoke, who drink, those traits are all contagious. So I've kind of made a conscious effort to call out some of the less healthy people in my network and expand my social network to have more healthy people.
Hmm. So presumably you didn't have to, like, cut out family members when you do that. That seems like that'd be difficult if you have family members that have bad habits. You can't really cut them out of your life. But I guess you would counteract that by having, like, a lot of...
No, I wouldn't say dump them. And I wouldn't say not help them in times of need. But you don't need to spend every Tuesday night with them.
Yeah.
So you may be enabling. I would never say dump your old friends. But you can think about how you apportion your time. And you can think about where you're spending your Tuesday nights and your Saturday afternoons.
Yeah, you can always expand friendships so that you're also around people who are, healthy. But the thing that I found interesting was your second book, Thrive, which talks about finding pockets of really happy people. And it seemed like happiness was sort of contagious as well as this idea of being fit being contagious. Is that right?
That's right. Unhappiness and loneliness are contagious. So if you go meet a friend who feels lonely, even though you're literally with somebody, you emerge from the friendship feeling lonelier. This actually comes from something called the Framingham Studies in the East Coast. Harvard psychologist MD called Nicholas Christakis did that work to find.
That's kind of horrifying, really, if you think that a lonely friend calls you up and you go, and instead of you cheering them up, they're kind of like bringing you down.
Bring you down.
That's a sad fact. But maybe the thing to do is invite a couple other people who are happy to be with you with the lonely friend. Maybe that would help.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe the unlonely, the happy one counteracts the lonely one on their impact on you. Again, I'm not saying dump those old friends, but I am saying to be aware that they have an impact on your health. They have an impact on your attitude, and your emotions, and your habits. And you should be aware of that and then decide how much time and what kind of time you spend with friends who have certain influences on you.
Well, it does seem if you look after your own positivity by spending, at least most of your spare time with people who are happy, then you're sort of spreading happiness in your community, and maybe eventually it gets back to that friend who is not, the
exactly.
most positive
That's very
person.
Perceptive. Yes. Because when it turns out that if you're happy today, that impacts not only your friends with whom you come in contact, but your friends of friends, and even your friend's friend's friend. So it radiates out three levels of magnitude. So it's a powerful thing to be aware of.
Another thing I'd like to explore with you is the power of the arts, because in Thrive you mentioned that in some communities arts are encouraged. Like even people that don't have a lot of money are encouraged to appreciate literature and art and music, and that this has an effect on how they feel about their lives, whether or not they're materially, very well off. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's a correlation. The people who spend a lot of time consuming arts also tend to be noticeably happier. And the example I pull out is Denmark. Denmark, interestingly, trains their children at a very early age. These institutions are called folk schools, where they, instead of teaching them a craft, they teach them things like consensus and how to sing and how to appreciate art and civics, things that aren't very important in our No Child Left Behind crazed school system. So here in Denmark, I was trying to be a detective, and I started with the data that showed that Danes self-report higher levels of happiness than more than any place else in the world. Now, what could possibly be explaining this? And the arts consumption, I believe, was one of them.
Well, that's pretty interesting, considering what's happening
in
the...
Isn't that just pretty interesting?
That is. Well, very interesting.
There we go.
Very interesting.
Just kidding.
So, and part of this exploration of the arts had to do with these flow rooms that some Danish households have. Could you explain what a flow room is?
Yes, it's a room that the family hangs out in. There's no TV, there's no clock, there's minimal computer screen, sometimes none. There's easy access to the hobbies and instruments that you might spend your free time engaged in. The table's big enough to accommodate everybody to do what they're doing, so they're together. Flow actually comes, it's a term coined by a University of Chicago psychologist named Mihail Csikszentmihalyi, who spent 40 years studying happiness and boiled it down to the notion of flow, which is the state you get into when your talents are engaged, you're being optimally challenged, it's not too easy, you blow it off, but not too hard, you give up, and 2 or 3 hours will just melt away. A flow room creates this environment where it's very easy to do the things that inspire flow. You don't get flow watching TV. If you've ever spent an evening watching TV, you get up and you sometimes kind of feel, did I just waste 4 hours here? You do experience flow when you're doing a hobby or playing an instrument or reading a book. It requires that mental engagement. It requires a little bit of challenge. And at the end of the day, it's where we derive huge satisfaction.
Well, I'm wondering, do you have a flow room in your house?
I have a flow house.
You have a flow house?
I don't watch TV.
Ever?
I watch 60 Minutes on Sunday night occasionally, but no, I never watch TV. I'm more interested in the radio. The radio is a much better medium.
So you talk about the importance of quiet, and I'm wondering, is there also, because I think you mentioned somewhere in Thrive, some information about how people need to have some silence, and it's good to live in a place that's quiet to be happy if you can. And like, what's the balance between playing music in your house and having silence in your house?
Well, it's unclear. There are some studies that show that playing Mozart specifically actually makes work go by faster and easier. If there's noise, it's the type of noise that matters. If it's a soothing white noise, it probably doesn't make any difference. But if it's a uproarious, interruptive noise, that's something that we as humans never adapt to. It's always going to bug us. Eliminating disruptive noise sources is a good idea.
Well, I want to get back to this flow room because I really love that idea. So if I wanted to create a flow room in my house, what should I do? So I guess take the TV out, and, you know, if I want to have a TV, have it in a TV place, but not in the flow room. So what else would I do?
Well, pick a room big enough. Get a big enough table that all the members of your family can sit around it. This is not a meal table, but this is where maybe kids do homework, and maybe you read, or maybe you have some kind of a hobby. You can sit there comfortably. That you don't want it cluttered. You want doors in there where you can put the things that interest you away and not your face. You don't want a clock in there. You can have some nice music in there. I like the notion of putting a flow room on the second floor so that if you're tempted to want to go get snacks, it occasions a walk down and back up the stairs. So
well, that's a good idea.
To buy food.
Yes, you don't put a refrigerator in there then.
No. You don't want to eat mindlessly while you're...
Yeah, no bowls of M&Ms on the table.
No. That's
okay,
that's,
well, that's good to know.
You can have an easy chair there. The trick with the TV, incidentally, TV watching does bring some satisfaction. Worldwide average, watching a half hour to 45 minutes of TV a day actually brings some intellectual repose, and we all deserve a little bit of entertainment, but if you're watching TV more than an hour a day, it's almost certainly at the cost of more authentic sources of happiness. So what I prescribe in the book is go ahead and have a TV in your house. Don't have four TVs. You never want one in your kid's room. It's very clear that children who have TVs in their room have lower grade point averages and higher BMIs. They weigh more. You want one TV in your room and an out-of-the-way place, ideally behind doors, so that TV watching becomes a planned, intentional activity, not one that you just automatically do. You come in the house. You never also want a TV in your kitchen. We know that people eat mindlessly when they have TVs in their kitchens.
Huh. Is that, like, that's interesting, too. Very interesting as well. So another aspect of a house that I found fascinating when reading your books was this Danish idea. Now, I can't remember how to say it. The hygge? Say it again? Hygge?
Hygge.
Hygge. Hygge. So explain what that is. I thought that was really an intriguing idea.
Yeah, so the Danes, like we in the Midwest, endure long, cold winters, even longer and colder than we're enduring this year. But the way they kind of fend off the gloom, they're big on candlelight. And they're big at getting together with their neighbors and their family a couple nights a week, and they light candles, maybe have a smorgasbord, eat a little bit. They still come from a culture where people sing for entertainment. We, unfortunately, the iPods replaced that. Typically, singing around candlelight is the emblematic hygge scene, but it's warm and wonderful.
Now, this is another one of those questions I have about, you've been exposed to this culture. Have you inculcated this habit of singing in your family by candlelight?
I light candles all the time. And, my kids and I are really good at playing chess and that sort of thing. We do our own version of it. I always light candles. I always make dinner kind of a special thing. I cook. I make everybody, I don't care what they're doing, they're coming around and sitting at the table. We talk about our day. We light candles. That's our version of it, and I think it's a real important building block for a strong family.
Well, the nice thing about these principles that you're identifying from talking to experts and then finding examples in the different countries you visit is the process of making these changes doesn't seem onerous. I mean, it seems like a lot of these changes would be fun to implement. It would be fun to light candles and, you know, have a candlelit dinner with your family. It would be fun to have a room with a big table where you have kids do artwork and homework. So do you find a lot of acceptance of these ideas when you go out and do public speaking?
Most of what we think bring us happiness is misguided or just dead wrong. We spend so much of our time in this country going after money or let's cut taxes or getting obsessed about government spending. The reality is money does buy happiness, but it doesn't buy very much happiness, and it levels off at a very low level. Buying things give a very fleeting source of satisfaction. There is a ton of data that shows things we should be doing bring happiness in our lives. If you want to get happier, evidence shows, the biggest thing you can do if you're unhappy is move. If happiness is a cake recipe, did I marry the right person? Do I make enough money? Am I healthy? You can't be happy if you're not healthy. Do I have a feeling I can give back? If it's the cake, the most important ingredient in that recipe, the factor with the biggest variability is where you live.
Wow.
So if you look at, if you go online and look at Gallup Health Ways Wellbeing Index, you can see the parts of America where people are happier.
Huh.
You say, well, I'm not going to move. No, nobody moves. Well, the reality is the average American adult moves about 10 times between the time they're 18 and the time they retire. So, yes, we do move. And if we want to get happier, moving is the biggest thing. Now, that's not so convenient. What's the other thing you can do to be happier? Well, the factor that most highly correlates with happiness is not how much money we have, not how big it are, not what our political affiliation. It's how much we socialize. The happiest people in America are socializing about 6 hours a day.
Well, that sounds like
so
a lot.
Getting out from behind the TV, getting away from the computer screen, and like our grandparents did, getting out, knowing your neighbors, spending time with the people in your community. We evolved as social creatures, and evolution provides a very clear guide at what we ought to be doing. We ought to be connecting, collaborating, socializing, and that will bring happiness.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to KRUU FM 100.1. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices, and with me today I have Dan Buettner, the author of Thrive, a book about how communities find happiness and what some of the universal practices are among happy communities, and also the book Blue Zones, which deals with longevity and what kinds of habits lead to longevity. So I find that really fascinating that the happiest people are spending so much time socializing. Now, is this in addition to being around people in your work? Because that sounds like, that'd be like 14 hours a day around people. That sounds like a lot to me.
Well, some work interactions count. Work interactions with people who care about you, with people who are pleasant to talk to, that counts. A meeting with your boss doesn't count. A sales call doesn't really count. But some time by the water cooler, a coffee break, a lunch with a colleague, a moment of chatting over the partitions, that all counts. So,
well, this sounds like...
It also counts socializing with your family, too.
Oh, so if you're eating lunch with your husband or eating dinner with your husband or going for a walk with your kids.
That counts.
Okay, that's good. That counts. Because this sounds like this might almost be harder than getting enough hours of exercise, getting enough hours of social activity. But talk to us a little bit about how the Danes, who sound like they're not naturally gregarious from some of the things that you wrote in Thrive, but how they overcome that and encourage people to be social.
Well, first you have to look at their cities, and this is what we're trying to do with the Blue Zone Community Project with Wellmark there. How do we set up sidewalks and bike lanes and ordinances so people are nudged into social interaction? You look at a Danish city, and you walk everywhere. You walk to the grocery store. They don't have these sprawling suburbs where they have to get in a car to do everything. They live in pretty concentrated populations. They belong to clubs. The government finances social clubs. The work week lasts about 37 hours, so they work hard. They knock off mid-afternoon, and then they're off with their hobby or their social club until dinner. Instead of working all day long, coming home exhausted, making meal for your family, and then collapsing in front of the TV.
Now, would this be different than having like our kids in a lot of? Cause sometimes it seems like our kids are kind of overbooked, where you have them like doing dance lessons and tennis lessons, maybe language lessons. Is socializing different than that, or is that the same thing?
You know, I don't know. That's a very good question. I haven't thought about it. But see, my knee-jerk reaction is if the kid's enjoying it, it counts. They're out socialized. Certainly better that than sitting in front of a video game or watching TV.
That's true. Maybe that era when people were taking their kids to all these lessons is really kind of diminished because the kids are more interested in exploring technology now than they were before. But also this question of moving. But first, before I go into exploring that question of actually moving, I do want to report that my community, I looked it up, your website had a link to what you can see how walkable your community is, and we were in the 98th percentile.
Oh, my hat is off to you.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased to see that. Even though the weather here is often so terrible, you don't want to go walking. If you do want to go out in the ice and snow, you can. This has been a mild winter, so we have been getting out more. But this idea of deciding where to move by deciding where people are happy, do you think anybody does that? I think most people move for economic opportunity or to be close to family.
Well, I think the first person to bring it to light was me in the book Thrive. All I can tell you is that the factor with the biggest variability in the happiness equation is where you live. If you take people from Moldavia who on a 1 to 10 scale report they're a 3 and move them to Copenhagen, Denmark, where people on average are about an 8, within about a year, the Moldavians, those unhappy people from a variety of walks of life, very quickly start reporting the level of happiness of their adoptive home.
And that's despite a change...
The new idea that I've suggested, but if you... the whole book, what I do is say, here's what the data, here's what the evidence says. Now, you can continue doing what you've done, or you can think about this, and here are some suggestions at changing your environment, your surroundings, so that you're more likely to be happy.
I have a question about what you just said, and that is, like, if you're taking people from one culture and where a lot of the people are unhappy and moving them to a place where a lot of the people are happy, are they becoming happy even though they've left their culture that they're used to behind? I always thought that there was probably
If you live in suburban Des Moines, where you have to drive everywhere, and it's probably to some shopping mall, and you move to San Luis Obispo, for example, or Boulder, Colorado, where the zoning laws are such that the resources of the community are focused to the center. So it's very easy to walk to grocery stores. People live in close proximity to each other, yet there is zoning such that there's a green belt, so everybody has equal access to nature, but they're living together. It's a lot easier to get that 6 hours. It's a lot easier to get that 6 hours of social interaction. It's a lot easier to have that access to recreation and to walk, to get the exercise you need, so you're not among the 68% of people there who are overweight or obese. All these have a really measurable and tangible impact on your overall well-being.
Wow, you're giving me a lot to chew on. You know, even though I've read the books, just talking to you is really useful, and I'm hoping that listeners are finding that to be the case as well. I've always been fascinated by how busy people accomplish what they do, and it seems like, you know, you're doing so much with your various ways that you're bringing information to the public. Is it hard for you to structure your day, and you know, still take time off to be with your family, or what's a typical day like for you?
There's way more to do than I have time to do, which I think is like most people. But at 5 o'clock, I just quit. If it didn't get done, it's not going to get done, and the world's not going to come to an end. So, yeah, I could do more. I have a really good friend, the CEO of a big company called the Holmes Corporation. I think it's about a $50 million company. And he had two girls he adopted, and he's married. And he said a year and a half ago, you know what? I'm just quitting at 4 o'clock, and my $50 million company might be worth $40 million after a few years because I'm not working as much, but I don't care. I'm going to live my life. And I had saw him for lunch recently, and I said, so, did you really do it? Did you knock off at 4? He said, yep. I said, so how about your company? Did it take a hit? He said, no. And nobody even recognizes it. In fact, I'm doing better this year than I've been doing in the last 3 years, so... Yeah, I think having that balance and being conscious of the whole you is really important.
Well, speaking of balance, and I can't remember which of your books you talk about this, but it seemed like maybe it was longevity, that having a purpose in life was really important. And you mentioned things about having a mission statement. And I'm wondering, do you have a personal mission statement?
Yes. What I'm good at is going into... traditional cultures and distilling out the wisdom they have to offer us, and that's what I like to do, and it's what I do best, and it's really the core of everything I do with Blue Zones and with these city projects and with Thrive. I'm not speaking from my heart or talking about personal experience as much as I'm finding the evidence-based populations that are doing things better than we are doing them, and suggesting how we might emulate them.
What qualities about you made you good at this, do you think? Is it just your ability to develop a rapport with people in different cultures?
Yeah, I think I have a true affection for people who live in different cultures. I love it, especially Latin Americans. I get their humor. I think I've had really difficult years. You know, I biked across Africa, and I biked around the world and through Latin America, and I lived among a lot of poverty and hardship, and it creates a sense of empathy. And I think that empathy is important, and people sense it. and they probably open up more to me than they might some network TV producer who's dropping in trying to grab a story and get out.
How much time do you usually spend in a place when you go to do an exploration?
Weeks. Anywhere from 3 to 15 weeks.
Well, that's a substantial amount of time. Do you maintain contact to some extent with some of the people you meet?
Yeah, all the time. I've been emailing some friends on the island of Ikaria in the last 3 days.
Well, that's one of the real advantages of technology. You can stay in touch, you know, assuming that the people that you've met have access to technology. But there are easier ways to stay in touch today. I do want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson hosting Writer's Voices. Monica Hadley and her mom, Carolyn, are not with us today, but we have Dan Buettner, the author of the book Thrive, which explains characteristics of happy community, the happiest communities in the world, and also Blue Zones, which explains some of the practices of places where people are long-lived and also healthy during their older age. So you've explored two things, longevity and happiness, Dan, that, you know, probably you could spend the rest of your life exploring, you know, finding as new research comes out, going into places where people exemplify principles that are isolated through research. But do you have a new project you're working on? And if so, what are you going to be exploring next?
Well, the big project's right there in Iowa. It's working with Wellmark and Healthways to create a blue zone, or three blue zones right in Iowa. So the holy grail of exploration is not so much what you find, but it's how you apply discoveries in the real world. And this these blue zone community efforts really seek to take the best wisdom from these places around the world and put them to work in Iowa.
So what do you think some of our obstacles will be, and how do you think we can overcome those obstacles as we try to adopt some of these practices?
Well, we live in a culture of ease and excess right now. It's much easier to go buy fast food than it is to buy healthy food. So what are the policies that can reverse that make unhealthy foods a little harder to get, a little bit more expensive, and healthy foods easier to get and more expensive? So that requires a mindset that doesn't agree with all political inclinations. It requires thinking not about how to optimize automobile traffic, but how to optimize foot traffic. An inconvenient thought, but it's one we need. People in blue zones burn 5 times as many calories in a day, not even thinking about it. Exercise is not working, so we need non-exercise physical activity. And that Americans are getting increasingly more isolated. In 15 years ago, the average American had 4 good friends. We're down to about 1.5 really good friends on average now. We need to nudge people out of their houses and create spaces in our city where it's natural for people to connect, easy for people to connect. And I think, to a certain extent, we have programs that connect people. It's not in a complex way, but just get people walking together and cooking together and volunteering together, knowing that of 100 people you get to do this, even though we'll lose 40% of them in the first 10 weeks, we'll gain 60% will keep doing it for a long run.
Oh, that's been your experience in the past with like Albert Lee? Was that how it worked?
So we did an Albert Lee. We called them Moais, it's a conceit taken from Okinawa, Command and Social Networks.
I kind of liked encountering these different words in your books, and because one of them was, like, in my family, I grew up in an Italian family, and there was this practice when I was growing up that if there was a family meal with extended relatives, you didn't leave the table for maybe 3.5 hours. I mean, you just sit there and talk interminably, and we kids would be fascinated, you know, just to hear the family stories. There were stories my mother told over and over about when my father was in the Second World War and she was managing a hotel. And, you know, there were just, like, it was family history. So we'd be sitting there listening to family history, but I never had a name for that. But when I was reading Thrive, and I sadly cannot remember right now what the word was, there was a word for sitting around after you eat. But I'll have to, I took notes and I'll have to look back in my notes, but I was really happy to have a word for that. I mean, I don't know if that was a healthy thing to do, but it wasn't like we continued eating. We just sit over the dirty dishes and keep talking.
Yeah, you saw that in Mexico.
Yeah, there was some word in there. I'll have to look up
Sunday afternoons.
But
Sobre Mesa, it's called.
Say it again?
Sobre Mesa, which means over the table.
Over the table.
So discussions over the table. It's a Mexican word.
Yeah, well, that was a fun tradition, and we still do that in my family at holidays. You know, my parents are gone now, but when I have friends over, we tend to do that. We don't move to the living room. We just sit there, you know, with our coffee cups and talk for hours, so it's kind of a fun tradition. But I do like the idea of promoting social clubs, and it does seem to me like if we can get ourselves to make these changes, we'll all be happier and our country will be in a much better position, because a big drain on our national resources are health problems, that many of which can be ameliorated with, you know, better lifestyle habits. So I think it's great work you're doing. Will you be visiting Iowa as part of your work on this project?
I was there last week, yeah. I'm there just about every other week in different cities. There's 54 cities have applied to be the next Blue Zone, and we're narrowing it down to 10, and we're going to go visit those 10 at the end of this month and the beginning of next month, one per day, and finally choose three, where I have a team of 50 people who will be trying to create Blue Zones, rallying cities who want to change and show them what to do, what works around the world, what are the evidence-based ways where you can change your society, or your immediate community, so that people are more likely to weigh less, to socialize more, to eat better, to move more, all the things that add up to greater longevity and greater happiness.
So Fairfield is one of the communities that has applied, and we'll be hearing on Friday if we pass through the next round. But whether or not we do, I do feel that the work you're doing is going to benefit all Iowans and ultimately, you know, outside of Iowa, everybody in the United States, if we can somehow turn it around, you know, and I don't think it's impossible. It's just learning to do new things. And it can be small things. Like I remember reading in Thrive that one community, maybe it was the one in California, changed their signage so that signs were less obvious and people weren't so tempted to go into like fast food stores.
Exactly. For individuals, I have a website, bluezones.com. And there's a free test that can help you calculate your life expectancy, and another one that can help you calculate how happy you really are, fusing both how you evaluate your life and how you experience your life.
Yeah, I've visited your website, and it does have lots of information. So if people are interested in honing in on more of what some of these practices are, that's a good place to find the information. And, of course, your two books, Blue Zones and Thrive, also have lots of information available. Will you be doing some public appearances here in Iowa, or is it mostly behind the scenes?
I'm going to be speaking at the library annual conference of the Library Association. Yeah, I've been there. I spoke to 750 people in Iowa City last Thursday, and then another 200 people in Cedar Rapids. So I don't know of any particular speeches coming up. But I'll be there.
Okay, well, that'll be good. It's probably not that different from where you are in Minnesota. Does Iowa look kind of familiar to you?
Right down 35.
I do notice, like, I was in California last week, and you do notice when you go to different airports, people look different. And sometimes when I am traveling and I get into the airports where we're, you know, going back to Iowa, you're sitting in the gate, we do kind of look around and see that we've gotten a little heavier than maybe we should be, but that's sort of a national problem, not just a Midwestern problem now.
That's right.
I remember seeing those maps, you know, there are maps that you can look at about how the nation has gotten heavier, and there were just a few holdouts. I think Colorado was one of the last to tip over, and maybe it's still above the curve or below the curve.
The average American's gained about 2 pounds per year for the past 20 years, and that's where obesity, it doesn't happen fast, it creeps up slow, so it's it's reversing the trends that caused it in the first place.
So if people are ready to make changes, do you have advice for how to get started?
Well, again, it's take those tools. You can't manage it if you can't measure it. So we have two really nice free tools for measuring your longevity and happiness, and there's a few free tips on our website that can perhaps offer you some customized advice. I did a speech for TED Talks, a 20-minute, since I probably won't be there speaking, but there's a 20-minute speech at TED.com. Just put my name in, Dan Buettner.
I think that might be on YouTube as well.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. So I think that's a pretty good start.
So getting back to the writing aspect of your career, I'm curious, were you always interested in writing, or was that something that you did so that you could do all this traveling and exploring and sharing of information?
Well, it was a tool to pay for things, really. I think an explorer, you're only successful to the extent with which you can share what you found. So developing that ability to tell a story, gather information, get people emotionally involved, I'd sell freelance magazine articles, and then it evolved into books, and it's always been an avocation, kind of what I do on the side, but it also helps you kind of refine your thoughts about things.
And I guess your public speaking was kind of a natural progression from your just being a good conversationalist with, you know, when you're doing interviews and things like that. Is that the case? Or did you, like, join Toastmasters or some organization like that?
No. I jumped out of the frying pan into the fire and started doing it. But I've done about 1,000 of them, so eventually you learn the tricks to get better at them. But once you've written about a topic, you've so internalized it, it's not a big leap then to develop a speech about it. The key with a speech is you tell people what you're going to tell them, you tell them it, and you tell them what you told them. And you make sure that the ideas you want to convey are all wrapped in a story. So you tell a series of stories, and people love you.
Well, that's a pretty good kernel explanation, concise seed form of how to give a good speech. I think we're coming to the end of our time. Do you have any final words for us here in Iowa and other people who are listening online?
I don't, other than I was delighted to have a chance to talk to you, and I'm glad there are still programs out there that promote reading and writing, and I salute you, and I've enjoyed my time with you.
Well, thank you for being with us today. Bye now.
All right. Live large.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.